Revelation 21, from 1 to 8. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, nor mourning, nor crying, nor pain, for the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. He who overcomes will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my child. The cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. So much to say. As we come to the end of these messages about end times, and we're just getting started on the end. This is not the end of the end. This is just the beginning of the end for this series. Here's the first thing that John wants us to know. Revelation 21:1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. This world is coming to an end. Not just this nation or this political system or this, it's not just your life or my life. This whole world is going to end. It has an expiration date. And that ought to change. Look at what Peter says about that. Turn with me over to 2 Peter. 2 Peter. Peter describes by the Holy Spirit the moment before John writes in Revelation 21:1. So if you want a timeline, put 2 Peter 3:10, exactly in that timeline before Revelation 21:1. And here it is, Revelation 2 Peter 3:10. But the day of the Lord will appear like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire. The earth and everything in it will be laid bare. Now, scientists tell us that there is a force that holds the atoms of the universe together. Every atom beyond the simple hydrogen atom, which is the smallest of all of them, is an amalgam of more than one proton. Helium, having only two, going up to ones that have several hundred in the very high atomic isotopes. Now, have you ever tried to push two very strong positive magnets together? What happens? They repel forcefully. But there is a force, in fact, there are two forces. Scientists don't understand them. They've simply cataloged them. They're called the greater and the lesser atomic attractors. We don't know how. We don't know how it works, but there is something that holds those protons, those very powerfully charged, tiny pieces of positive matter together. And like holding two ends of a magnet, two positive ends of a magnet together. They are constantly trying to come apart, but there is an attractor that holds them. What we have here described is the day that God lets go his hand and those atoms fly apart. The elements themselves melt. An atomic explosion, not of a few grams of matter, but of every piece of matter in the universe exploding simultaneously. No wonder it's described as a roar. No wonder the King James describes it as melting with fervent heat. We know how hot an atomic bomb gets at its core. We know that from horrific experience when the people went into Hiroshima and Nagasaki after World War II, the only time that human beings were ever deliberately exposed to an atomic explosion. They found shadows permanently cast on the walls where the bodies of people had been obliterated with such force that they simply, their shadow, the outline of them was melted into the wall. That day is coming. Now, here's the question. Look at 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 11. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, your house will be destroyed. Your car will be destroyed. Your wardrobe will be destroyed. Everything you own will be destroyed. I remember the testimony I heard of a student. He was an engineering student, and he was nearing completion of engineering school. And he went and he heard the gospel preached, and he surrendered to Christ and became a Christian. And he went back and he started reading his Bible. And when he read those verses, he said, why should I dedicate my whole life to building things that God's just going to destroy? I want to build things that last forever. Now, I am not criticizing engineering. It's a noble profession. But we need to have the mentality that says this stuff will not last. It's not worth living for. Can I just digress 1 minute? Why do you think we have so many kids that are angry and hurting? We see college campuses that are filled with children that are rioting in the streets. We see it on the news. Why? These children that are raised today have more than any children in any time in history. Kids look at me when I describe my childhood and they go, oh, how'd you even live that way? Don't they do that to you if you're a little older? How'd you live without cell phones and the internet? A lot happier than you do. And there's a reason. The Bible says a person's life does not consist in the abundance of their possessions. We have said if you just give these children more possessions, more video games, more entertainment, if you let them go to more movies, if you give them better food to eat and a bigger house to live in, if you just give them more government assistance and programs, if everything is given to them, they'll be so happy, and they're not. Because the Bible's true, and those that oppose it are liars. And when Jesus said that a person's life does not consist in the abundance of their possessions, he knew what he was talking about. Things don't make us happy. Things wear out. I remember years ago, Dr. Dobson, back when he was the head of Focus on the Family. Yeah, couldn't. Senior moments. They come with greater regularity. I remember him saying, he bought a swing set for his kids. And I remember doing the same thing. And he went out and he was tightening all the bolts and tightening all the bolts and tightening all the bolts. And I remember when I did it, I sat down. I was going to have some family come down and help. And we were. I figured, oh, it would take an hour or two, and then we'd go out to dinner. 4 hours later, we're still out there. And the kids come out going, are we going to dinner yet? I'm starving. Well, you're starving. What about me? And he said, that was fine. It took hours to put it together. That was fine. But then he read in the instructions, if these bolts are not tightened on a weekly basis, danger could result. I have a different philosophy. Let the nuts rust onto the bolts, and then you don't have to worry about it. But he said, who owned who? Did I own that swing set, or did it own me? I'm out there every week tightening those nuts just because I don't want my kids to die. It's all going to go. It's all going to go. What kind of people, since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought we to be? What priorities should we set? What matters? I remember talking with my brother one time, and he talked about going on a business trip, and they had these people from, I believe it was China, that was there, that was talking about buying some of their product. He said, yeah, we took them to this restaurant, and the bill for 10 of us was $3,500. He thought that was just wonderful. I thought, what could I do with $3,500 more than a single meal? Even if it was 10 people, even 10 meals. But this whole life is just like a single meal. It's going to be over in a blink. As somebody was saying earlier, you know, it wasn't that long ago. And I look, I've got what? Under 4 months, 3.5 months, and I'm going to be 60 years old. For some of you go, oh, you little kid. For others of you, you're going, 60? That's like 392. Did you ride dinosaurs when you were a kid like me? But it doesn't seem like it's been 60 years. I go, 26 years I've been here? Are you kidding me? I was 33 years old when I came here. I look back because Janet made up a photo montage for her Nana's funeral. And I look back at some of those pictures and I go, what? You ever do that? That face in the mirror, it ain't that. This life roars by at such frenetic speed. And it's all going to be gone. What kind of people ought we to be? And Peter asked that question. How should we live? Because there's a new heaven and a new earth, how should we live? What should be important? What should we pass on to our children as important? What should we tell our children? No, we never give up this. This is important, but if anything conflicts with it, that goes, this stays. Sadly, for most kids today, it is some secular event. It is sports, or some club, or some activity. And you know, if church has to be abandoned, oh well. What would happen if God's people universally said, I will never violate the Lord's day? I'll never violate the midweek. That's the highest. Having my child at Bible study is my highest imperative. Having my child at church and Sunday school is my highest imperative. Well, but there's this activity. So-and-so's having a party. They're their best friend. Well, I'm sorry, it's Sunday. What a testimony that gives. What kind of people ought we? Because this stuff's going to be gone. Then John says in Revelation 21, not only will there be a new heaven and a new earth, but he makes an interesting thing. He says, and there was no longer any sea. Now that sounds kind of strange to us. What does that have to do with anything? Now, remember last week I talked about how John is describing things that are indescribable. There is no language to actually tell us what he saw because we have no words that describe it. I'll give you an exercise that I was given years ago by someone. They said, close your eyes, describe a monster that is utterly unlike anything you've ever seen. Think about a monster that is unlike anything you've ever seen. Okay, you thinking about that monster? What's it like? Why, it has eight eyes. Excuse me, you've seen that. You've seen eyes and you've seen eight of things. You've just combined two things that you've seen into one. Well, it has 15 tentacles. Okay, you've seen tentacles and you've seen 15 of something. You've just combined them together. Anything you thought of when you closed your eyes in that little thought experience, anything you thought of is something you've already seen, just recombined in a different way. You cannot think of something you've never seen. That's why you cannot describe the color red to a blind person. You can't do it. So John cannot tell us what he's actually seeing. He simply describes it in words and things that he would understand, that we would understand. He says, there's no more sea. Now to us, what difference does that make? In fact, seas are a good thing for us, aren't they? They allow cargo to move very, very cheaply around the world because there are seas. Why would there be no sea? If you go back to the days before interstates, rivers. Water was the only way to transport. That's why the first things they did in America was they dug canals. Why no more sea? Here's why. Because the Jews were not a seafaring people. The Jews never had a navy. They never sailed. They never had a merchant fleet other than the little boats that went out on the Sea of Galilee. They never went out on the Mediterranean. If they ever wanted to do any kind of shipping, they bought sailors and ships to do that. For them, the sea was a great separation, and they didn't have any means to overcome it. Even at the height of Israel under King Solomon, they never were a seafaring people. The sea, for the Jewish people, in the Jewish psyche, in the Jewish mindset, stood for separation. And so John says, there's no more separation. There's no more border that you can't cross because out there, it's deadly and dangerous. There's nothing in this new heaven and new earth to keep people apart. But we are constantly kept apart today, aren't we? How many really good friends can you have? How many really good friends can you have? It's not just because people mistreat one another. It's just you cannot have really good friends. You can have a lot of acquaintances. You can have people that are you are friendly with that when you see them, you go, oh, it's been too long. But you cannot have more than 10 or 12 good friends. Why? Because there's just too much that separates us, starting with time. There's not enough time. It takes time to be a good friend, doesn't it? It's interesting, and I had someone, a psychologist, who wrote a book a number of years ago, and he was talking about friendships and how important they are in Christianity, and he said, it's interesting that Jesus didn't pick 100 disciples or 1,000. He picked 12. Why the number 12? And he made the claim that 12 is about the maximum number of people that you can be in an intimate friendship with. More than that, you simply don't have enough time and enough ways to divide yourself, to give enough of yourself to maintain that close friendship. We're separated. How often does someone move away and, oh, we'll stay in touch, we'll stay in touch. And do you? And maybe somebody will say, yeah, we did, so-and-so, and we have. But boy, is that common or rare? It's rare. Distance separates us. Time separates us. Commitments separate us. I remember David saying years ago, well, Dad, you don't have any friends. I said, I've got some great friends. He goes, but you don't go out and party with them every night. I said, no. That's not what an adult friend is. He goes, you don't call them up and hang out at the mall. I said, no. If they called me up to hang out at the mall, that'd probably be the end of the friendship. Ah, run! The mall is that place you run into when you have to and run out as quick as you can. Kathy and I always had an argument. She would like to start Christmas shopping, you know, in August. And then we'd find presents that she'd stashed someplace on into the next August. I said, no. You go Christmas shopping on one day. You make your list up. You run in. You say, here's the list. Bang, bang, bang. You grab them. You pay for them. You come out. You're done. She looked at me and goes, you can't do it. Yes, you can. If you laser through the store, no. Oh, no. It's interesting. David's now getting a little older, and he called me up, and he goes, yeah, I understand what you mean about friends. All those guys that I thought I was hanging out with that were such great friends, they're the guys that let me down. Yeah, they weren't friends at all. You see, in the new heaven and the new earth, there's nothing to separate us. There's no time. You don't have to say, oh, I don't have enough time for you, because there is no time. Whatever there is, and I don't understand it because I've never lived without time, it doesn't exist. I can spend forever with someone and not have used up any time at all. I don't understand that. It makes no sense to me, but that's what it is. And then he says, look what he says in verse 2, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, presented as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. I don't know what that city is. We're going to look at that city in a lot more detail. I don't know what it actually looks like, but I do know this. It's a place where all God's people come together and there's nothing separating them. Today we're separated by distance. We're separated by experience. We're separated by perspective. There is no one who has a different perspective of anything in heaven, because we all see God's perfect perspective and know that that's the right one. And it's not my opinion, your opinion. It's simply the right and the wrong. We have erased the destruction of the Garden of Eden when Satan said to Eve, you'll know in and of yourself. You'll determine what's good and what's evil. We'll know what truly is, and we'll see the truth as it really exists. I did better than last week, folks. I got through halfway. We're not just in the introduction, but we need to stop here today because I don't want to rush the next thing that God says. I want us to really take time next week to really look at this idea that God Himself will be with them. What does it mean for God to be with us? I don't want to run through that. I don't want to jump through that. Because that is such a precious thing. If you want to talk about the heart of heaven, it is exactly that. And we're going to do that next week. But we need to close today, and such an appropriate day to do it by sharing the Lord's table. Because, you know, all the wonders that we are hearing about heaven, they're only available because Jesus died and rose again. There are not many ways to God. There's not many paths to heaven. There's not your way and my way. If I'm going, I remember saying to a baseball player on a church softball team one time, I said, well, I know when I die, I'm going to heaven. He goes, well, yeah, that's because you're a pastor and you've done all these good things. And I looked at him and I said, if I stand before the gate of heaven and say, I'm a good person, I've done a lot of good things, I'll be where you'll be. Because my way, neither my way nor your way, will ever get any of us to heaven. There's only one way, and that's Jesus' way. Jesus prayed to the Father, if there is any other way. There wasn't. If being a good person could do it, Jesus could have walked away from the cross and said, well, all they've got to do is be good. He couldn't. If paying enough money, there isn't enough money to pay. If religious activity or fervor was enough, Jesus could have walked away from the cross and said, just let him go up to the temple and pray 3 times a day or 5 times a day or 10 times a day or say this many hail that or bow this or, but it wouldn't. Jesus said, this is my body broken for you. It's the only way.